We are flirting with climate disaster.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We're broadcasting from stolen land, land that was never ceded. As NAIDOC Week draws to a conclusion, we'd like to acknowledge the accumulated depth of knowledge that they've gained by nurturing both their land and their communities for millennia before their land was stolen. And in that ancient wisdom lies so many of the solutions as we face up to the climate crisis.
We need revolution, says David Suzuki. And who is he? He's one of our world's environmental elders, you could call him, in line with, for instance, Sir David Attenborough or Jane Goodall. He said that in an interview with the Canadian news outlet iPolitics, where he talked about Trump, the American president, who he sees as a triumph of capitalism and neoliberalism, and as someone who is going to wreak havoc. And Suzuki is not in a good mood. The fight against climate change is lost, he says. The units of survival are going to be local communities. So I'm urging local communities to get together. And he points at Finland as a place that's offering a great example, because the Finnish government has sent a letter to all their citizens warning of these future emergencies that are coming. Whether they're floods, droughts or storms, they're going to come. And they're going to be more urgent and prolonged, says the government of Finland. And governments will not be able to respond on the scale or speed that is needed for these emergencies. So the Finnish government is telling their citizens that they're going to be at the front of whatever is coming, whatever hits. They better be sure to be ready to meet it. Find out who on your block can't walk, because you're going to have to deal with that. Who has wheelchairs? Who has the fire extinguishers? Where's the available water? Do you have batteries or generators? Start assessing the routes of escape. And David Suzuki from Canada is telling us you're going to have to inventory your community. That's really what we have to start doing now. And that is, in many ways, what we have started doing here in Geelong, in the Geelong region. For instance, Surf Coast Environment Group has been running a resilience course for some time. And now Geelong Sustainability, a group of 10,000 people, are opening up a new resilience program as well. And we'll be talking, I think, quite a bit about that and also about the economical side of this in the Sustainable Hour today. But first, it's time for our weekly global news bulletin. And we have, as our listeners would know, Colin Market, OAM, ready at the news desk. So what's the outlook? What do you have for us, Colin?
Well, it sort of nails down what you've been talking about, Mick. It illustrates the polarization, if you like, of the environment at the moment. Because our roundup begins this week in Washington, where President Donald Trump's giant tax and spending plan that he called the One Big Beautiful Bill was passed without any changes last Thursday. It's a $4 trillion package that he calls the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and it's now ready to take effect across the US. It'll slice into every aspect of the nation's efforts to address climate change and environmental injustice. It's essentially 887 pages of legislation that largely erased the landmark Inflation Reduction Act from President Biden, who is a Democrat and, of course, President Trump is a Republican. So the Inflation Reduction Act from the Democrats invested in clean energy, jobs and communities. And that was just 3 years ago. It seems quite a distance away from today's perspective. The new legislation effectively cuts out all incentives for buying electric vehicles and energy efficient appliances. It phases out tax credits for wind and solar energy. It opens up federal land and water for oil and gas drilling and increases the profitability for both industries, while it's creating new federal support for coal industries. It also ends the historic investment in poorer minority communities that carry a disproportionate pollution burden. But that was money that the Trump administration had already stopped in its first month in office. And it effectively wipes out, cancels, or wrecks any and all spending on greening in all areas of the US federal government. It's a stark shock to the economy and to the world's efforts to shut down pollution. So, on to the saner politics of Europe, where in London last week, London's Guildhall, more than 2,000 climate leaders from business, governments, finance and civil sectors all met for the UK's annual Climate Action Forum. The event was hosted by Britain's Climate Action Group, and its speakers were encouraged to unveil plans ahead of this year's COP30 in Brazil. The idea is to get in ahead of the fossil fuel industries that tend to dominate the COP meetings. Among the guests encouraged to unveil plans ahead of this year's COP30 were the COP president and the Brazilian Environment Minister. They heard from Britain's Energy Secretary and Net Zero Minister Ed Miliband, who delivered a clear vision for the UK as a clean energy superpower. Does this ring any bells with you? How long have we been talking about Australia becoming a clean energy superpower? But Britain is now claiming it. Ed Miliband outlined the concrete steps being taken to accelerate the UK's global transition to net zero. It's all going to be detailed in the COP30 in Brazil. As such, he emphasised the dual opportunity to create a new generation of well-paid green jobs and secure long-term industrial resilience. He also spoke of the role of the finance sector, especially insurance, in bringing pressure for action against climate change. The Lord Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, said that Transport for London, which is the city's largest single consumer of electricity, had awarded a multi-million pound contract to supply it with solar power for the next 15 years. This marked significant progress towards the capital's goal of running 100% of its public transport on renewable energy by 2030. That's less than 5 years ago away. The mayor also unveiled a new climate finance task force to help unlock capital investment needed to meet those London's net zero targets. "We must be doers, not delayers," he said, opening the fifth round of a £500 million green finance fund aimed at delivering projects across the city that will deliver energy efficiency, clean transport renewables and heat networks. Now, also at this forum, Linda Freiner, the Chief Sustainability Officer of Zurich Investment Group, addressed the stark and growing recognition that climate change is a financial risk. She said, in simple terms, "If it's not insurable, it's not investable." And this is going to make a big difference with the funding for new projects. And she forecast that the insurance and finance would have a significant place at COP30 in November. But back to America, where is hitting the headlines are the floods in Texas, the deadly floods in Texas this week, which have dominated the headlines but in California, more than 300 firefighters are battling a massive blaze, foreboding the threat of summer wildfires arriving when President Donald Trump has slashed funding to federal agencies tasked with fighting them. The Madre Fire broke out last Wednesday in San Luis Obispo, a rural county in the heart of California. About 200 residents were evacuated, with dozens of buildings under threat. It's the biggest blaze so far this year in California, which is still scarred by wildfires that destroyed swathes of Los Angeles at the beginning of the year back in January. The Madre Fire spread quickly. In 24 hours, it engulfed more than 21,000 hectares, according to the state's fire service, CAL FIRE. Images from the state warning system showed columns of black smoke overhanging mountains in the hilly remote region. And the Madre Fire follows several other blazes, and it's very, very early in the Californian fire system. It's raising fears of a difficult summer ahead for a state that's already traumatized by those January fires. They killed 30 people. The Texas floods so far have killed more than 70. Now to Norway, where a $134 million satellite that was on a mission to detect oil and gas industry emissions of the greenhouse gas methane has mysteriously been lost in space. The satellite is called, rather obviously, MethaneSat. It's been collecting emissions data and images from drilling sites, pipelines and processing facilities around the world ever since March. It went off course about 2 weeks ago, according to the Environmental Defense Fund, which was running the project. Its last known location was over Svalbard in Norway, and the operator doesn't expect it to be recovered, as it has lost all power. The whole project was backed by billionaire Jeff Bezos, who, if you remember, got married last week in Venice in a small ceremony. EDF Senior Vice President Amy Middleton said that the launch of MethaneSat in March 2025 was a milestone in a years-long campaign by EDF to hold accountable more than 120 countries that in 2021 had pledged to curb their methane emissions. It also sought to help enforce a further promise from 50 oil and gas companies to eliminate methane and routine gas emissions made at the Dubai COP28 climate summit in 2023. But EDF Vice President Amy said she had the last word. "We've made so much progress and so much has been learned already that if we hadn't taken this risk, we wouldn't have any findings," she said. "We're seeing this satellite loss as a setback and not a failure." And she made it pretty obvious that they intend to continue holding the countries and the companies to task for their unlisted methane emissions. And that fairly positive note ends my roundup for this week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Wayne Wadsworth. Our regular listeners would remember that a while back now we had Wadsie on talking about he's the safer, more just, inclusive world that we're all yearning for. Today he's back on to talk about WEBs, Worldwide Eco Banking Systems and Community Wealth Banks. So, Wadsie, welcome back.
Thank you. And so, I did listen to the world news in terms of Ed Miliband and what's happening in England and their desire to be a carbon neutral country. But if you look at what's realistically happening, especially in the United States, you've actually got the reverse happening. They're going, "No, we're going to drill, baby, drill." Yeah. And you have to then understand, well, why is the United States so keen on drill, baby, drill? And then you have to go back and see why the United States is so keen on oil. and it goes back to the American dollar itself. You've got to trace the banking system itself and why we actually need a new banking system. I think without actually developing a global new banking system, oil will predominate as a major thing that's destroying the planet, because oil is what props up the American dollar. Without oil, the last bastion of the American dollar is gone and the American economy collapses. So, and it's something I've been thinking about over many years. You know, like, I've been involved, obviously, in the whole green thing for, well, I'm getting 70 this year, so 40, 50 odd years, you lose track. And we've gone backwards, really. I think since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc countries, we've seen trade unions, all those organisations of working class sort of politics have been continually dwindled down. The Greens, you know, the environment movements have been either starved of funding or sidetracked. You know, where we were sort of moving forward globally in a whole lot of areas, we've stagnated and in many ways gone back. I mean, some places, you know, we've gone forward in some ways, but particularly if you look at the United States, which literally runs the world economy, they're going backwards at a great knot, number of speed now, you know, drill, baby, drill, the whole thing. And then you have to understand, well, why does the United States really stand out almost against the rest of the world in saying, yeah, most of the world is saying, look, we've got a problem, you know, we can fix it, it's not that difficult. And the United States are saying, no, we haven't got a problem, we're going to keep drill, baby, drill, there's no global warming, there's no environmental crisis, we can just keep going. And why is that? Why are they... There's a relatively large section of the American ruling class who want to keep drilling oil. And if you have to go back into the banking system, a little bit back into history. So if we go back, you know, if we follow the whole banking system back to the Stone Age, basically, what was the first bank? It was a dead carcass. You know, you could cook that carcass, and if there was some left over, you could trade it with the tribe down the road, you know, for a bit of labour or spearhead or something like that. So banking's not a new thing, and that surplus value isn't a new thing. So tribes learnt that if you had a surplus, you could trade with other tribes, and if you could preserve that surplus, as in cooking or preserving seeds, you could use that as trade. So banking is a very primitive old thing. It's the evolution of banking and the power of the banking system itself that changed. You know, as we move through history, we then had actual bankers. You know, that first banking system was based on gold. So if you had gold, you could, you know, go and buy other things, and you could go to war against that tribe or that country. As long as you had enough gold to do it, you could pay for it. But the bankers learned that if they could store that gold and then print money, more money than gold they actually had. So it became what's called the gold reserve. So in particular, the people that got it down in the Middle Ages started banks, and they said, all right, well, you put your gold in here and we'll give you a promissory note against that gold. And then they realised they could actually have more promissory notes than they had gold. So then they could fund the kings and the queens, and they could fund wars and things like that. So they did. They funded, in many cases, they funded the French and the English in banking systems. So the Rothschilds in particular at Waterloo were able to, they knew that Napoleon had lost the war, but they led the stock market to believe that the English had lost, and they bought all the stocks at a very low price. And when the English found out that the British had actually won, stock prices went up and they cashed in big time. So that really started that thing where, okay, we can profit from war. You know, we can actually have the finance and profit from war. And then the British pound really relied on that gold backing. I mean, you look at the British Empire, it was the most impressive empire of all the empires. You know, they were able to, this scungy little wet country, colonise the whole world through currency. You know, it was what they say, the pound sterling. It was backed by metal. And they were able to run a global economy. And we talk about globalism. Globalism's been here since every empire. But the British Empire had an amazing empire that was based on gold and then being able to print money in relation to value of dollar. Now, if we then go to the First World War, where all that sort of broke down to a large extent, but at the end of it, the Brits won and the pound sterling was still the global currency. The Second World War changed all that, because at the end, the Americans stayed out of the war quite deliberately, and let the fascists sort of, I think their idea was, we'll come in when either side's winning, and we'll make a buck anyway. So they were selling, before the war, they were selling everything to the Nazis and everything to the English as well, on both sides. But their cleverness was to stay out of the war and then cash in at the end, which is what they did. You know, they didn't join their war till, 1943. And at the end of that war, England was broke, literally had spent all its reserves. It actually owed America hundreds of millions of dollars. So the Americans never, ever gave anything to the English for free. It was either leased or they sold it to them. So at the end of the Second World War, Britain was in a huge war debt to actually the United States bankers. And that's where the whole change came. They brought in the Bretton Woods Agreement, which literally handed the British Empire to the United States. And the agreement with that is that the United States would literally take over the empire and everything would be based on the US dollar. So all trade would be go through the IMF and the US and the US dollar based on $35 an ounce for gold. And that worked pretty well, you know, for quite some years. Vietnam War came along. United States went from a creditor nation to a debtor nation because they had to print a whole lot of money for the war. And in 73, I think it was, 71, the French went over and said, we've got a whole lot of your dollars. We want our gold that you all got stored in the New York Reserve. And very shortly after that, Nixon withdrew the gold backing from the dollar. So, you know, it went from being $35 an ounce to $300 an ounce very quickly because we had so much currency that it just printed. So that we all thought at that time that that was the collapse of the American empire. But then they devised a plan to back the currency with oil. So the plan was that the Saudis in particular would sell all their oil in US dollars. And the return for that was that the Americans would make sure that the Saudis weren't overthrown in a revolution or something like that. So they put in military bases right throughout the East, Middle East, and basically protected all their interests. And that's why the Middle East has been such a mess since then, really. And so that was actually created a credit boom where, you know, we saw the introduction of credit cards, lots of privatization of different industries that were run by the government. And if you follow that, that ownership of and control of all the global currency through oil is the kingpin that holds the United States together now. So if that falls apart, what holds up the dollar? You know, if you look at it now, I mean, the completely bizarre thing about it, the American debt, is that China gives money in bonds in America so they can buy Chinese goods because they don't have the actual money to buy it. So literally the Chinese are paying Americans to buy Chinese goods, and the same with Japan. So and the Americans have sort of come to realize, well, we can't just keep going into debt because at some stage you're paying more in interest than you actually now. I mean, I think it's something like 30% of their income just goes on interest. So if interest rates go up, the debt in America is not payable. And that's why you have to understand that's the reason why Trump is so pro-oil, because that's the only thing that's really backing the dollar. So how do we face that? You know, we've got IMF, World Bank, Bank of International Settlement, all in US dollars, which control the global currency, and also they can bankrupt countries. You know, if an African country wants to say, look, we want to get off your dollar, well, you've seen it, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Gaddafi were all overthrown, not because they were bad guys, and they probably were, but they're overthrown because they wanted to get away from the dollar. Now, the thing is now you've got BRICS, which is a very powerful organisation because there's China, Russia, Brazil, some really big hitters in it. So they can't, and Iran too, yeah. But how do you, you know, like, if that's the case, how do we change that? Because the whole environment thing can't change when you've got one country that runs the whole global economy and they're dependent on oil to do that. So I think BRICS is a good idea in terms of, yes, it does take away that power of the United States to, you know, overthrow countries and and keep the dictatorship going. But in itself, it's not a democratic organisation, and the whole banking system is very undemocratic. You know, so to me, we need to develop a monetary system where people control. It's not controlled by bricks or by some tiny minority of people. And so that's sort of where that evolved from the idea of Webb's, a worldwide eco banking system, in that at the moment you've got a tiny group of central bankers who run the whole system. We don't know how they run it or what they do or what their secret meetings, none of that's public. So if we had a system where every country was a member of that global bank, so for example, let's take the United States, 300 million people, and then you've got India, 1.2 billion people, they would have the members on that board would be reflective of their population. So every country would have a board members on that international banking system that decide the policies of that bank. It's not just decided by the United States, which is the case at the moment. So it's a lot more democratic, because they can't just go, oh, we're going to fund the overthrow of who we don't like because they've gone, you know, we can't go to Africa and we're going to cut off your credit because we don't like what you're doing. You're feeding your people and you want to do sustainable farming and you want to plant trees and you want to get rid of the oil. We're not having that. So they can overthrow those governments just by cutting off funds, which is what they do and what they've done for the last, particularly the last 20-odd years since the oil was backing for the dollar. So I think that's the first stage, and it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, because you've got the most powerful organisation in the world that decides the global economy. You're saying, well, we want to get rid of you and replace you with something else. That's certainly not an easy task. So it has to be like in three stages, in terms of, if you looked at Australia, for example, we had our own Commonwealth Bank many years ago and they flogged that off, so we don't have a publicly owned bank anymore. But if we had community wealth banks in Australia, so we have a federal community wealth bank that deals with the global situation, much like our reserve does at the moment, and then you have, and the federal government, our federal government, gives grant money to communities. So in Australia, we've got councils all around Australia. So that grant money would go to councils, who would then distribute that money in their council area. So you'd have community wealth banks within those council areas that actually run the economy of those areas. And that's a really important thing, because of the changes coming. We've got 3D printing, we've got AI and robotics. So those three things, and people don't realise, are going to change things more than any technology that we've ever had. You know, if we look at the technology that came in, we all thought computers were going to all put us out of work. They didn't. In fact, it created a lot of employment. AI is different in that you can close a whole factory and run it literally without staff. And they do have factories in China now. They actually don't have any staff. They don't even have lights in them. It's all run in the dark because they don't need lights. We're going to see the disappearance of manufacturing jobs. It's going to be in industries like medical industries. And, you know, if you've got an AI thing that can store the whole history of legal practices and every legal court case has ever fought in the world on one computer, and you can have that, you know, you don't need hundreds of hours of research. Even now, you know, we know ourselves, you can, Mick was saying, you know, you can do this radio thing, type in a whole of words and it comes up with, and he sent that to me the other day. Amazing. These technologies are coming, and unless we develop systems that can interact with them, we'll get swept aside. We might be lucky if we get a bit of money each week that the state pays us, but it won't be a very pretty world for most of the people. You know, the people at the top would be probably doing pretty well, as they always do, but it won't be very pretty for the rest of us. So unless we get interactive with those changes that are coming, whether we like it or not, and we are very much cognizant with it and what we want out of it, as people at the bottom of that list, what do we want out of AI? What do we want out of robotics? What do we want out of 3D printing? In reality, in less than 20 years you'll ever have a 3D printer on your table that'll be able to print your mobile phone or most of it. I mean, I had 3D printers 3 or 4 years ago. I could print all sorts of amazing things just by downloading a program, paying $2 from Bamboo to download the file for it and print it on my table. That technology is here now. It's not something that's coming, and it's going to speed up like everything does. Society do we want, and how do we interact with the financial system that's going to have the capacity to produce enormous amounts of goods and services way above what we think now? And do we want to have, you know, 10,000 more things? How do we interact with that? Yeah. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. We need to start talking about that. And, of course, the environment comes into that hugely, you know, because all this new technology can bring amazing things. You know, we can produce all the technology we need to clean up the planet. You know, there's three basic things we need to clean up the planet, which is pyrolysis, so we can, you know, turn all the plastics and all that back to its, back to what it was. We can do away with a lot of the plastics and go plant-based. You know, what do we want as people with that technology? So, and I think that's the question we have to really start looking at, and what financial system will allow us to be part of that system. If we're shut out of that financial system, we're just at the bottom of the line and we might get a handout, you know, which is...
That's exactly. I mean, there's one big word, Watsi, that rings in my ears, and that is the word control. Control. Mm. How do we change every other words that you have given us here and that insight into action when there is such a strong control already on that system? They're not going to be happy if we sort of rebelled and began to make our small community banks, eco banks, 20 people got together in one place and 20 another place and so on. That would be seen as rebellion.
It would be, yeah. Yeah. And I think quite a bit. It is, we can, if you look in Australia now, we do have community banks. Like I'm in a bank called Beyond Bank. It's actually owned, I'm a shareholder. It's actually owned by us. And it can loan money, it can do all the normal things, most of the normal things a bank can do. Unlike big banks, it can't create money out of thin air, which big banks can do. So they've restricted the little banks, unable to do that, which obviously gives the big banks a hell of a big advantage over little banks. I think what we can do to start with is get people to join those, you know, to leave the Commonwealth Bank or the big banks and join their own community banks that are already owned by the community anyway. So I think that would be a big step. Now, what happens when that starts happening in mass? The government will intervene and on behalf of the big bankers and restrict it, as they do. I mean, we saw set up the Grameen Bank, where in, I think it was Bangladesh, which is tremendously successful. It helped poor women become entrepreneurs and set up small businesses, a tremendous bank. And the government intervened and richly, you know, wrote off the bank. They made the bank borrow money to rich people, and the bank was never set up for rich people. So they will intervene, but the point is we can, and I think our job is to educate people about how the monetary system works, that it can work on for us, not against us, you know. Mm. And if the government does intervene, we can have campaigns to say, well, why are you intervening in our banks? They belong to us. Why do you need to, you know, hand them over to the big banks? So I think we have to develop an argument around why we should have community wealth banks and why. And what society we want from those community wealth banks, because things are going to have to be localised hugely when all this technology comes in, because we won't need to transport goods thousands and thousands of miles. So actually be able to be produced quite closely. You know, like a 3D, I buy a roll of, I can buy a roll of organic plastic, actually. I print on hemp plastics, for example. And I can have that sitting on my lounge, and you could have community print shops that print out local goods. You know, you don't have to, it doesn't have to come from China. So even the effect on China is going to be huge, because then they really know, they don't now become the industrial hub of the world where everything comes from. You know, poor countries can start printing their own wealth. So this is a huge change.
This is so interesting in a way, because you remember I started today with saying a quote from David Suzuki in Canada saying we need revolution. But the thing is, it sounds to me like a revolution is coming whether we like it or not.
It is coming, yeah.
So the revolution is here. It's only a question about how do we respond to that.
Yeah, I agree 100%. The AI revolution is here. It's not coming. The 3D revolution is here. The robotics are probably 2 or 3 years away.
And self-driving cars.
Probably in 3 years, you'll be able to go and purchase a robot for $30,000 or $40,000.
I think the listeners just need to understand what you explained very quickly about what I did with your book. You've sort of made a draft of a book about this eco-banking system and everything. If listeners are not aware, in the last half year or so, we have not been playing other people's music. We have been producing our own music in the Sustainable Hour. I think we may be the only podcast in the world that actually has this process of that we take an interview that we have done, put it into AI, which makes first a transcript and then turns the transcript into a draft song lyrics. And then I go through the lyrics and we put them into another AI that produces some music. I modify it a bit. And within an hour or two, we have a song, which is an excerpt of an interview. So it's a journalistic song, you could say. It's the concentrated version of what this person, the message of this person. And we did that with you and Mims last time you were in the Sustainable Hour. You seemed to be okay with it at the time. And so I thought this time I'll do it in advance. So I can play it for you now. I took your book and I threw it into AI and I said, do you see any potential for a song from all this writing that Watsi had done here? And do you know what the AI said? Yep, I can see some good lyrics there. And it came out with this. Choice is ours. What do you think?
Wow. Awesome. I mean, I'm kind of tripped out. I've just turned 30 and I'm still very bad with AI. So I'm kind of tripped out how good quality that lyrics was, the pacing, like for that to have been computers, robots, samples of voices to have whipped up that, that could have taken months.
So just to the listeners, who's talking here is Mims, who came together with Watsi, but you've been very quiet until now. You were together last time in the Sustainable Hour.
Yeah. No, it was just really an honor to hear you speak about it again, about this system that we've been kind of raised in with a lot more naivety and hope that, you know, at some point we'll make it and we'll end up with our two-bedroom, three-bedroom house and we might have the honor and privilege of being able to procreate and continue on this species. And the older we get, the more that seems like not only just a foreign concept, but also ends up with this very cynical, disconnected, lost, kind of down and out of luck mentality that I see in many of my generation, where it's, but why should I try? They've already told me my degree is not going to get me employment. So why should I try? And that mentality limits the capacity, I think, as I hang out with incredible minds such as yourselves, it limits the capacity of energy that we do have. Yes, we don't have all the answers between 15 years old and 30 years old. You don't have all the answers. But as we've just seen from the AI capacity, if we are to believe that an algorithm can focus more on the truth behind the questions that we're asking, and hopefully we are creating servers and systems that don't have necessarily political biases, that they are just collating as much data as they can, so that when we fish for our answers, we are getting a comprehensive approach to that. I think there is hope. You know, it's biblical and there's probably other spiritual texts that have it that say, like, our elders dream the dreams. They've got the lived experiences. They've seen the nightmares. They've lived through fire, floods and droughts that weren't connected to the rest of the world like they are now. When a landslip happens in Nepal, we get to learn about it in Melbourne, in Sydney, and vice versa. When we had the fires rip up the East Coast, American, Canadian firefighters were on hand. We now have a global community, which ties us into, well, where do we go from the banking structure? And that's where my favorite thing is, looking into these communities. My one little thing, which I've just found, and I just really, it summarizes it really well in my mind, is that there can be five community categorizations of communities. And this is coming from the foundation of intentionalcommunities.org. One is the cultural preservation. Are you having a community to culturally preserve something? Are you guys, you know, for instance, Amish or Hittite is the examples they had. Are you preserving a way of life? And that's why you're starting a community or a business or a village or wherever you're entering into with this group. Is it economic security, the cooperatives, the food banks, the ways that we are able to then create like the source bulk food where we all go to a place that has grains and pastas and rices? Is it going to benefit us economically? Is it a service-based community? These sort of constructs that our generation, you know, we see Vinnie's and we see the Salvation Army and their homelessness appeal, and we feel like they're doing something. So why do I need to do something? Someone else is already doing something. Or is it identity-based refuges where we saw through Epic where people had an idea and they wanted to be supported by other people? So 40,000 Australian citizens went to Canberra to start an identity-based community where we all found different identities once we got there and realized that humans aren't easily controlled and that people still end up wanting to be able to be right about their opinions. And the third one, the fifth one that she comes up with is the quality of life. So just even in flickering through those five things, What is your intentional community going to look like in 5-10 years from now? Is that something that you're going to chip in with your friends, get 10 or 20 people together, putting $20 in a week for a year and seeing what's possible at the end of that? Or is it joining one of the 500 different intentional communities in Australia, learning from their prototypes, what they've developed, their legal structures, guidelines, because something more than likely is going to fit for you. And you're not too far gone. I'm talking particularly to us 15 to 30-year-olds who feel like it's too much. You have the world at your fingertips with these sort of people who have already spent 40 years setting cool things up. We're just here to add that energy and that next drive, the bridge to the automation and augmentation of our reality.
Thank you. To Mims, who is traveling together with Wachi and today had her own response, you could say, to everything that you have told us, Wachi. Wachi, what was your own feedback on the song, which was like an extract of the booklet or this sort of draft book that you have written?
Yeah, you sent it to me the other day and I listened to it and I was sort of blown away, to be honest, because I remember I was with a woman quite a while ago, and we sat down and we wrote a song and we sang it. And it probably took us a couple of days, and it was fun, but it wasn't what you call professional. And I was amazed that it could take those words, which were quite complex, and then put it into a very listenable song.
So just two things to add to that. I think it is a collaboration between human and machine in the sense that I am very much the editor of everything in that process. And I do make remakes and remakes and remakes until I'm satisfied. And by the way, I am a musician myself. And also, it should be mentioned, I don't do this for money. I do it because I see it as a new way of communicating the same things as you're saying in your book. How would that go out if it was in a song? And could it reach a different audience in that way? I think that's what I'm experimenting with. It's poetic journalism, you know, music journalism in a way. And it's a new genre that hasn't existed before. And I'm getting a lot of criticism, especially from musicians, saying this has no soul, you're in the wrong space. But I'm still experimenting. Because here's one thing is, and I think you're aware of that as well, Wachi, AI is not going away. Can I just put in, Geelong Sustainability has just launched a community climate resilience training program, and you can sign up to that. There will be training sessions in October, and if you go to Geelong Sustainability's website, you can register your interest. There's different ways of participating. I think that is a very important initiative locally, where everything that you have talked about today, Wachi, also integrates. These questions that you're raising definitely are part of that discussion. So this story doesn't end with this program. This is a new beginning.
Just one thing, you know, we've been setting up community gardens in Australia probably for 30 or 40 years, and the failure rate's quite high, and the failure rate in community farms is quite high. And it's really, we need to look at why those things fail, you know, and there are reasons for it, obviously. And I think AI can play a huge part in making those more successful, you know. I'm not worried about AI. If we use it wisely, it can be a great tool. Or if it's used against us, it could be a horrible thing. You know, any technology can be used for good or bad. You know, you can hit a person over the head with a guitar or you can play a nice song. So what are we going to use the AI for? Let's use it to repair the earth. You know, we've got a whole earth to repair. There's no lack of work for us. And if someone loses their job in a factory and they want to go out and do a community garden, wouldn't that be a great thing? You know, they've still got a lot more worthwhile thing to do in their community probably and be part of that community. So, you know, we can use AI to actually build communities, and that's what sort of excites me.
How do we transition in a way that reduces death, illness, destruction, and moving, you know, how do we just reduce what seems to be inevitable? Because that's what they keep pitching, depopulation, move into the cities, the deserts are increasing, you don't want to be out west, all these kind of distortive lies instead of let's create communities out west that have self-sufficient feedback loops with water and sunshine. responsibility at all. Talking about no soul for your song, now we can take those lyrics and remix them. Like now all of us Muso friends, we can take those lyrics and we can make it into something. So thank you for even coming up with that.
Exactly. It's just a draft. It's just a suggestion, and you can take it further and you can make a real human recording. You can even play it live around the bonfire. So this was all we could fit in this particular Sustainable Hour. Any last comments?
Yeah, I think that Wadsy's got a thesis prepared for us, I guess, Wadza Festo, and we'll put links to it in the show notes. But I think there's lots of – it's not just a theoretical operation. It's how to actually implement it as well, and we need that more than anything. Yep. It just reinforces the fact that we have choices as we transition to this new world. Wadzia, I'd like to congratulate you on the paper that you've produced from this. There's lots of important information in it. I think today we just kind of just covered the theory, but there's many practical applications as well towards the end. Now, right at the end, you've got this page, What's Your Utopia? What would you like our listeners to do with that?
Well, I wrote that paper because everybody's got a different utopia. You know, if we all asked each other what our utopia would probably be different. And that's not a bad or good thing. I think it's a good thing that people do have different ideas of utopia, because as we develop the AI and collective intelligence, we want people to enhance their own intelligence, you know, and their own understanding and what really they want in society. You know, how do they see their community, and what's the best thing that would be good for them in that community? So it's a very challenging question if you ask people what their utopia is, you know, because they actually have to sit down and think about, well, actually, what is my utopia and how would I build that utopia, you know? So really, programs like this, I think, can empower people to think about, okay, I think utopia is a great idea, and I don't agree with Wadzy's utopia. I've got my own utopia, and in my community, how could I build that? So really, if we look at the renaissance of every city, you had artists and you had, you know, huge expressions of art and culture, and they're all different. You know, you go to the European cities where they had the renaissance. Pictures are different, you know. Art started to change, you know. You had Bruegel painting working class people, you know, and that was a renaissance. So, you know, I think AI could really bring in a renaissance of that whole creative things. I mean, look at the cities we're building. They're so ugly. God, I go into Melbourne, like, how could someone build such an ugly monstrosity? And then you go to Europe and you go to places where with a renaissance and beautiful buildings and, you know, and they could build this 400 years ago, and we're in this bloody thing now, and we're building crap, and we're in ugly suburbs and ugly cities. Why are we doing it? It's good that we can get people involved. So when we are developing a suburb, it's what people want. It's not shifting in there because, you know, we've got this thing, get a mortgage, pay for the rest of your life, live in a sort of isolated community that doesn't have any social services, and you go off to a job. And that's not going to exist. That's the point. You know, we're building all these suburbs that people are going to go off to an office and work all day. In 20 years, that's not going to exist. You know, so how do we make those communities really exciting and vibrant and creative? You know, and that's what I think. We need to have these places that are creative and people involved in their community. And that excites me about AI. And that's what's going to challenge us in this next period, you know. How do we make AI work for us, not against us?
Oh, look, I'll just say that we now face a huge challenge. AI adds so much more than just making songs out of the air. It's collecting information on every time you click or every time you look at a screen. And that information can be used in so many ways. It can be used to help humanity, and it can help be used to control humans. And that's the worry that I have. But I will say that I found it really astonishing that that was not a human voice singing.
I did too.
And now I can recognize AI. Thanks to you, Mick, I can recognize AI completed songs. They're now got a sort of a recognizable pattern to me, and that's bound to change as well. But look, I'll finish up this episode by saying, be part of the future. Be aware of the future.
Be ready.
Be ready for it, yeah.
And find people who are more competent if you are not. We had an amazing phone call with a cybersecurity expert last night. He's got it covered. They've got it covered. There are people out there who have the things you don't understand covered. They've gone to do the courses, the universities, the lectures, the field days. They've been there. And maybe they just don't have your final piece of the puzzle.
Be in community, because that's where you find your people.
Yep.
Yep.
I'll go with that.
True.
Health authorities are warning Australians to stay out of the heat today as temperatures climb yet again after heat records were broken yesterday. Australia's ongoing heat wave has been pushing temperatures to almost 50 degrees Celsius.
Hush now, little one, the night feels long. The world outside can seem so wrong. But here by my side, you're safe and warm. Love still matters, yes, even more. You grow your roots around the storm. You're not in meant to face this alone. The stars shine, can you hear they sing? Even through despair, you'll find your way. I feel the weight, I see the storm. I do my best to still keep us warm. The clouds are dark, the water's cold. I carry you both, the young and the old. I grow my roots around the stone, and I'm not meant to face this all alone. The stars shine, I can hear them sing. Even through despair, I'll find my wings. It's okay to cry, this hurt we feel means we're still awake. But don't build your home in the pain you find. Let love and hold your mind. We'll grow our roots around the stone. When I'm meant to face this all, the stars shine, we can hear them sing. Even through despair, we'll find our way. So close your eyes, my precious one. The fight's not over. System, but we still belong, and only love will keep us strong. And only love will keep us strong.
We, the people who live on this planet, have the capacity to make the changes necessary to save our future. The greatest president in my country's history, Abraham Lincoln, said at a time of dire crisis, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty. We must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, we must think anew."